My name is Meade Treadwell. I'm Lieutenant Governor of Alaska, and I have the distinct honor and pleasure to open this conference today and to be your Master of Ceremonies this morning. I also chair the Alaska Historical Commission, and we're very proud that the Alaska Historical Commission and the Friends of Nike Site Summit were able to bring together this conference to celebrate the 25th anniversary, the end of the Cold War, and to invite and to convene 60 Nike veterans here who we're very honored to have with us here this morning. And let's have a round of applause for our Nike veterans. Before we get started, I'd like to do two things just very quickly. First, I'd like to thank the members of the Historical Commission, our co-chairs, Barbara Probst, my chief of staff, and Jim Rankert, who's director of the Friends of Nike Site Summit, for organizing this conference. But also to let you know that the Friends of Nike Site Summit is an organization, an umbrella organization that has brought a large number of people together to help preserve one of the most amazing Cold War sites in Alaska. And if you haven't had a chance to tour it, you will have a chance this weekend to visit the Nike Site Summit out at Arctic Valley. And I'd like to thank Doris Thomas, Bob Mitchell, Allegra Hammer, who's with the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, Judy Bittner, who is with the State Historic Preservation Office, and Joe Antonsen, the State Historian, Bob French with the Friends of Nike Site Summit, John Scudder with Jay Bear, Darrell Lewis with the National Park Service, John Klo, who is with the Friends of Nike Site Summit, but John, your experience as an historian at Jay Bear and your membership on the Alaska Humanities Forum has been wonderful. Sue Ellen Novak with the Alaska Veterans Museum, and many, many others. I think it's appropriate that we also remember the late Doug Beckstead, who was the Jay Bear historian who passed away this summer, all of whom wanted to convene this conference and have worked very hard for the preservation of that site. So with that, thank you very much to the organizers. Now, when I get around the country, and I'd also like to thank first Sergei Khrushchev and his wife Valentina. It was wonderful to hear your talk last night, and thank you so much for coming out from the East Coast to join us for this conference today. Your point was that you had strong leaders who were humans and put a human face on the Cold War, and I want to thank you for coming to put the human face on the Cold War with all of us. It's been tremendous. We had a chance to spend the day Wednesday going down to Seward with the Khrushchevs, as well as Bob and Mary Margaret Wallace. Ricky Ellison is here, and you'll be hearing from him shortly. And we had a chance to be in a town that was named after the American who negotiated the purchase of Alaska from the Russians, to be at a place where we saw animals named after William Henry Dahl, who had been here part of an overland telegraph project to link the continents. We talked about how we had both been to the Russian Far East, to Irkutsk, Mr. Khrushchev, where there had been a camp built for your father and Eisenhower to have a summit, a third summit, I guess it would have been, which was shot down when Francis Gary Powers was shot down with the U-2. But there I saw Shelikov's grave. We talked about how the purchase of Alaska was linked to activities in Crimea, which has echoes with current times. And we talked about how we've worked as Alaskans since the end of the Cold War to open the border. And I just want to say that as chair of the Historical Commission, we've tried very hard to make sure that these anniversaries have been properly recognized. In Alaska, and we'll learn much more about this from the experts today, but I think of many different Cold War sites that have changed our state and have helped defend the country. We, of course, had the Dew Line, and here I'm not knocking the wrong slides. We had the dew line, and many Alaskans know that we had the dew line, but maybe Alaskans don't know that if you read Section 10 of the Alaska Statehood Act, the land north of the Porcupine, Yukon, and Kuskokwim River was reserved by the Eisenhower administration so that any time the Department of Defense could take that land to use it for defense purposes. So General Handy, just know that you can take our land if you need it, but do you have to properly deal with it? We tried to see if we could get Secretary Rumsfeld to open ANWR with that clause at one point. You know, those of us who know about our base in Shemya, you should know, and I've got a friend who was running the listening post when we predicted and then confirmed the launch of Sputnik, and there's been lots done there. If you go over to Elmendorf and you see the elephant cage and you look back at the history of KL-007 and know how important our HF listening capability there and at Misawa Air Force Base in Japan has been to our security. If you go out to ADAC and you look at the old Navy base and know about the SOSIS network and know about the picket fence that we had to look at submarines moving in and out of the Arctic, that was tremendous. If you think about Cobra Ball, which was a set of electronically equipped aircraft that were listening and watching and taking notice of what was happening in Russian missile testing, you saw that Alaska had a major role there in the Cold War and actually confirmed the first Russian MIRV tests were confirmed here from Alaska with that mission. We had the Queen's Match missile launch out of Shemya. We had Operation Cold Feet, which I think you'll hear Bob Wallace talk about today at lunch. We had an RTG sensor net where the Air Force had placed seismic sensors around the northern part of Alaska to help confirm Russian missile testing and nuclear testing. We had some of the first receipts from our first spy satellites were landed here and took pictures of Cape Schmidt, the nearest Russian airfield to, or one of the nearest Russian airfields to us. And then, of course, the blind man's buff detailed the activity that U.S. submarines had to break into the Russian cable in the Sea of Okhotsk. So Alaska has been very much on the cutting edge of the Cold War for some time, and I think what's most important about this conference today is that we do three things. We give appropriate tribute to those who have served, and I'm very glad the Nike veterans are with us today. I think we also should make sure that we have an appropriate respect for the role of Alaskans in defending the United States and ending the Cold War. And early in my career, I found it fascinating, and this is when I first got to meet Bob Wallace, that the Reagan administration, part of their plan was to try to deny Russia as much cash from oil, gas, guns, and gold as they could. And they saw Alaska as an alternative to Sakhalin Island gas for Japan. They saw our coal as an alternative to Russian coal to Japan and Korea. And we worked very closely with the Reagan administration at that time as part of their plan in the same way they were trying to deny Russia gas markets in Europe. We were working with them in Asia. And so Alaska had a role not only in fighting the Cold War, so to speak, but also ending it. And that leads us to having an appropriate understanding also of Alaska's strategic mission today. And with that, I'd like to invite up Lieutenant General Russell J. Handy to speak on your military in Alaska today. Alaska's military has a storied history in defending our nation by both land and sea. And from power projection in World War II to the Nike Site Summit to rapidly deployable mobility and fighter forces, our involvement in Alaska has been large. General Handy is the senior Department of Defense official in Alaska and the best expert as commander of the Alaskan Command in the U.S. Pacific Command, commander of Joint Task Force Alaska in the Northern Command, commander of the 11th Air Force and Pacific Air Forces, and commander of the Alaskan Region North American Aerospace Defense Command at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Alaska. He integrates all military activities in the Alaskan Joint Operations Area, which synchronizes the activities of 21,000 people on active duty. And how you do that, I can't somehow seem to get the beds made and the laundry done at our house with five, but I'll just tell you, that's pretty amazing. General Handy was commissioned in 1983 through officer training school after graduating from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and he's a command pilot with more than 3,600 flight hours, who participated in combat operations and deployments including Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Desert Fox, Southern Watch, Noble Eagle, Iraqi Freedom, and New Dawn, and came here after serving at NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command, as chief at the Headquarters Advanced Programs in Peterson Air Force Base. General Handy, thank you very much for opening our program today.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, not only for that kind introduction, but for sort of taking the pressure off of me today, speaking, you know, following Dr. Khrushchev as a speaker. Gee, thanks for that. Tough act to follow, sir. Thank you for participating in this conference, and also inviting three former ALCOM commanders today who I think may be hiding in the back row somewhere, so they're all taking notes just to give me a few comments on, you know, what they think about the presentation after today. You know, I grew up in the heart of the Cold War, as Lieutenant Governor Treadwell indicated, entered the Air Force in the early 80s, and so, you know, my entire professional career was framed by the kinds of tensions that we all lived with. The majority, the vast majority of people that Colonel Bruckbauer and I serve with now on active duty were not even in the military when the wall came down. And so they have a very different perspective and a very different understanding as children, or in some cases folks that weren't even born, of the tensions and the tightrope that you all walked as you manned that site on the hill, protecting us for so many years with not only deterrence, but real capability should that capability be needed. So you all are American heroes to me, the Nike veterans that are out here today, and we really are honored to host you here. What I will tell you is that although a lot has changed since the wall came down, we've clearly for 23 and a half years been focused in military activity in a distinctly different part of the world with a distinctly different type of military challenge. Here in Alaska, many of the types of challenges, both environmentally and from a military strategic perspective, are very, very similar, although they've evolved over time. The men and women in uniform today are still thinking very much the same way that you did about deterrence and about military capability. And I think if you get out on the flight line or get into our shops and interact with these young men and women, if you've ever been discouraged in your life about the future of our country, spend about 10 minutes with these young men and women and it will transform your opinion. We are fine. These folks are incredible. They come up with new and innovative ideas on ways of doing business that I never would have thought of, and that's a good thing. What I'd like to do today is talk you through just a little bit about that, what I enjoy most in my career, and that is bragging about the men and women in uniform and what they're doing in the context of today's strategic environment, which, as I say, many of those same challenges you lived with, we're seeing, in some cases, seeing some of those kinds of uncertainties magnify. So this is the environment we work in and we live in. It's pretty vast, but it's also uncertain. I throw this picture up here today because I think it really captures not only the environment that we live in, but a little bit of the uncertainty in a couple of ironic ways. So that's me shivering because it's really cold here. It's 100 miles north of the north border of Alaska in the Arctic Ocean. About 6 months ago, the Navy did a test with submarines, two submarines, the USS Hampton, which is behind me. It's just broken through about that much ice. And the USS New Mexico is actually underneath us now, orbiting, you know, waiting for its turn. And it was a very exciting time. I spent a couple of nights up there on the ice. The Navy had constructed a camp to be able to conduct this vast number of experiments with their submarines and communications devices and a host of other activities that we were involved in. I left here, got on a little plane to fly back down to Dead Horse. 5 minutes after I took off in that plane, a lead, which is a fancy word for a crack in the ice, broke between the camp and the runway, isolating the camp from the runway for a period of time. we don't know this, of course. We're happy. We're flying back to Dead Horse. 24 hours later, that camp began to break apart, and they had to evacuate the camp of all of the inhabitants. The tests went on. They monitored them from elsewhere, but the camp was now unsafe. This is after months of researching exactly the right place to put this camp. And so I will tell you that as sophisticated as we are, this environment is uncertain. And I think ironically, it's symbolic of the strategic environment that we live in today. The strategic environment that our men and women are serving in is very uncertain. We don't see our challenges reducing. We're coming out of 23 years of intense combat in one way, shape, or form in the Middle East. We still have a lot of activity in the Middle East. As those of you, all of you here in the audience know today, activity in Europe is certainly not reducing, and we're rebalancing our efforts to the Pacific, and we're doing all of this while we are reducing our force structure and figuring out how to do these missions with an increasingly challenged amount of resources. So we'll talk through a little bit of that today. Billy Mitchell was a great air power advocate, and he said a lot of smart things. He wasn't always as popular in D.C. as he was with the airmen all over the world. You know, he got into a little bit of trouble off and on, as those of you who have studied air power history know. But in 1935, he called Alaska the most strategic place on Earth. And I think he was very accurate then, and he certainly would be accurate today. And even Billy Mitchell probably didn't envision just how strategic a place Alaska is. Those arrows represent the fact that we are really singly closer to every place on the globe than any other area with a military base in the world, which makes Alaska very important for a variety of reasons. Last year, when we deployed F-22 aircraft to the Middle East for the first combat patrols in that aircraft, the most advanced fighter aircraft in the world, they flew from J-Bear from here on our base, and they got there as quick as they would have from Langley Air Force Base on the east coast of Virginia. And clearly, we're very close to all areas of the Indo-Pacific where we're focusing a lot of our effort. The picture in the left-hand corner was taken in 1943. That's a B-24. You know what happened in the Aleutians during World War II. We were the only piece of North American territory to be invaded by a foreign power. And I will tell you, Alaskans, don't forget that. We'll never forget that. And a lot of the organization that I live and work with today was based upon that never happening again. That environment was fairly harsh. The upper, your upper right-hand corner is a radar site. It's one of many radar sites that we maintain in the state of Alaska for surveillance and tracking of aircraft entering or nearing our airspace. And that was taken about 20 years ago, and that site looks just about like that today. So we still maintain those radar sites. On your lower right is an F-15. It's not a US F-15, though. It's a Korean F-15 from the Republic of Korean Air Force. Last year, when sequestration budget problems in our military forced us to cancel virtually all of our major exercises and training events for a number of months, the two major participants in the only red flag exercise that we kept flying in Alaska were the Republic of Korea Air Force and the Kokujetai, the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force. They were the two primary, what we call blue air forces, flying together in an exercise of that type for the first time ever. Unprecedented. So it represents not only the operational significance of this place, but the fact that we have the best training ranges on the planet, the largest joint air ground training ranges in our Department of Defense that are a center of gravity, a strategic resource for us. And of course, the lower left, you all are familiar with a picture like that. There's still air defense going on. That was just taken a couple of months ago. That's one of our F-22 Raptors intercepting a bear bomber within our air defense identification zone. It was an unidentified aircraft, you know, until we went up and had a look, and we still ironically do that quite often. I don't want to bore you with the organizational chart for too long, but I thought it might help to capture who we are, so what we do here in our headquarters. So as Lieutenant Governor Treadwell indicated, as the commander of Alaskan Command, I also wear a few other hats. We'll just kind of walking from right to left. The one that you're likely most familiar with is the Alaskan region of the North American Air Space Defense Command. a NORAD, and that's based on a very strong binational agreement with Canada, and we work together with our Canadian partners every day. Ironically, as the focus in the NORAD mission in the lower 48 states has evolved to what we call the mission Operational Noble Eagle. Operation Noble Eagle is a, you know, very focused on a potential rogue aircraft threat, hijacked terrorist threat. Much of the focus in the lower 48 is on that. We continue to do that mission day to day here in Alaska as well, but our focus is more on nation state actors. So aircraft from nation states, fundamentally Russia, who are getting close to our airspace, and that's still a very active mission we conduct out of our headquarters here in Alaska. On the left, as the 11th Air Force Commander, I'm responsible for organizing, training, and equipping, so as a management headquarters for all of the airmen here in Alaska, in Hawaii, and also in Guam. All of our operational wings in those three locations fall under our command here. Those forces are presented to combatant commanders all over the world, so not just North America, not just Pacific Command, but Central Command, European Command, wherever those forces are needed. And then in the center is this Alaskan Command Joint Task Force Alaska team, and that is the senior military representative in Alaska, encapsulates everything else we do, to include homeland defense and a very intense role of supporting civil authorities anytime we have a disaster such as a volcano, an earthquake, which we have hundreds of earthquakes every week here in Alaska of some degree of magnitude, or any other natural disaster. Department of Defense is there to assist the communities, and we do that out of our headquarters. We are also the advocate for Arctic requirements, and I'll talk just a little bit about that later, because when I say Arctic, that's really the environment we operate in here all the time, and we're the only part of the Department of Defense here in Alaska that's in the Arctic. So we're very much the executive agents for that for DOD. I'd like to walk through just very quickly a few pictures on the forces that we have here in Alaska today. And we'll talk through by mission, because I think it's the easiest way to think about it, what they do for you as a nation. The one thing I'll stress is, as I walk through our forces, which are really substantial in Alaska, the thing that continues to make us very effective is teamwork. Every mission that that you would interact with here at J-Bear or on any of our other bases within the state, you'll see a mix of active duty, Department of Defense, Air National Guard, Army National Guard forces, reserve forces, Coast Guard forces, other government agencies, all coming together every day to get the mission done, unlike anywhere else I've ever served. This place really lives and breathes teamwork in everything they do. Based on the vast nature of our theater and all of the missions that we have to do, it's really the only way to get it done. I know you all are interested in air defense, so all of the little dots on the map up there in some way contribute to air defense. There's no Nike sites up there anymore, sadly. I wish we had some. I wish we were still serving with you on that hill. But we'll just have to look at the star and remember, now. But I will tell you, we still sit alert with F-22 aircraft here 24/7, 365, varying numbers of aircraft depending upon how much activity we're anticipating. But our F-22s are on alert and very active. We also have E-3 AWACS command and control aircraft here that sit alert as well with us, and tanker aircraft at Eielson Air Force Base as part of the 168th Air Refueling Wing from the Alaskan Guard that sits alert with us every day as well. A number of other resources all over the state. The primary ones that I have pictured up there are those radar sites that I had a picture of earlier, and they are essentially providing that first radar look. We have a variety of other sensors, as you might imagine, from a variety of other sources that give us a lot of intelligence and information to feed into that network as well, that it would be too vast to picture on this slide. What's also not pictured on here that maybe doesn't contribute to air defense every day are all of the other Air Force forces in Alaska. We have a substantial number of them. Fighter aircraft, as I indicated, mobility aircraft, C-17s, C-12 aircraft, and also KC-135 tankers, and our aggressor F-16s at Eielson. And most recently, the United States Air Force announced Eielson Air Force Base to be the preferred location to base the first F-35 fighters that are going to be based overseas. So we are in the middle now of an analysis, a full analysis with the community to ensure that base is ready to bring on 48 F-35s in on or about 2019 timeframe. So that's very exciting. We are also the center of gravity in Alaska for the United States Ballistic Missile Defense Program. So while we don't have air defense missiles to shoot down air-breathing threats, we do that with other assets. We certainly do have a substantial capability around missile fields at Fort Greely. So the majority of our ballistic missile defense interceptors that are in existence today, and the ones that we're getting, because we're getting more, are operated out of Fort Greely by, again, an incredible team of Missile Defense Agency, Space and Missile Defense Center, and the trigger pullers, the individuals, young, very young men and women who sit at the console and would pull the trigger and launch if needed, are Alaska Guardsmen that do that mission 24/7, 365. And we have a variety of sensors, primarily here in Alaska, the ones out at Erickson Air Station, at Shemya, and at Clear Air Station, that provide very important input into that system as well. We still retain a large Army presence on the ground, active Army presence in partnership with their Guard brethren. We have 12,000 soldiers on the ground here at Fort Wainwright and Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, four brigade-sized units, airborne brigade, striker brigade combat team, an engineering brigade, and an aviation task force that, as you know, have been very focused in the Middle East for about the last dozen years. As those men and women come home and refocus their efforts in other areas, obviously they're still going to be in and out of the Middle East to some degree. Those folks are really re-caging their Arctic skills, because they really are the Arctic experts in all of the Department of Defense. And so what you're going to see in Alaska now is much more of that activity, Arctic mountaineering skills, and it's attracting a lot of international partners who are coming to train with us on our ranges and learn from our soldiers as well. And then, although not a part of the Department of Defense within my chain of command, but certainly no less a partner, is the Coast Guard. Coast Guard District 17, headquartered in Juneau, an immense capability throughout the variety of their mission sets, and we partner with them every single day on a variety of missions ranging from search and rescue to homeland defense. So all in all, we, as military men and women and their families, make up about 12% of the population of the state of Alaska, about 80,000 folks. And that doesn't include our retirees, which, for those of you who have retired in Alaska, know there's a lot of you. What we find are people that come and serve in Alaska tend to like it, and then they love it, and they want to come back here forever. So we have lots of people who have retired in Alaska, and that's a good thing for us. It makes it a very supportive community, the most supportive community to the military I've ever seen. Served in bar none, and a tremendous place to serve, in all of those dots all over the map. This is the only big laundry list I've got for you, but I thought it was interesting to think about the kinds of missions we do with all those military forces. You know, the ones in green are sort of the ones that the military, you know, are primary, and the ones in blue are the ones where we are the supporting entity but still very active. But interestingly enough, I pulled this list word for word from the President's Arctic Implementation Plan. So President Obama published a policy with regard to the future of the Arctic, and he published a fairly detailed implementation plan which outlines how he sees all of the government agencies employing. And so the good news is all of the things that we're being told to consider in the Arctic Implementation Plan are all those missions that we're already doing. We just need to be able to do them well and be equipped to do them in an evolving Arctic environment, which is very much a work in progress. I would say there are probably a small number of entities physically involved in the Arctic, but that amount is growing, and there's a large amount of potential users. And what we see in the Arctic is, again, very, very much an evolving environment. Not just militarily, strategically, but economically. This is just one piece of those economics. About 22% of the world's undiscovered oil and gas reserves are in the Arctic. Over half of those are within Russian leases or Russian potential leases. Obviously, the U.S. is a close second to that, but the Russians are very, very interested for many reasons, and this is just one of them. And if you look at this picture, it portrays oil leases that are in existence currently as of the end of last year, and the ones that you see in this orange and blue color, which make up the majority of those, were all just signed in 2013. So just last year, those are new leases. So Russia's getting at it. They understand where those oil and gas resources are, and they're very active in partnership, as you know, with some U.S. companies as well, to go at those resources. And you can see many of those are very close to our U.S. oil leases. So if you put four scientists in a room and you ask them what the Arctic's going to look like in 30 years, you get four different opinions. You know, just like fighter pilots, we all have our own opinion. Scientists are no better. But this is about the best body of research I've ever seen done on the ice cap and what we think it may look like. This was done by some scientists out of UCLA. And they took historical data back to 1979, and they overlaid that on predictive data, and they studied, what I like about it is they didn't make bold assumptions one way or another. They studied a broad range of different greenhouse gas assumptions, in other words, climate change assumptions, and they brought those together and did some averaging and came up with what they envisioned to be the picture now, so you know, into about 2015, and then the picture on your right is into the middle of this century. And the lines are nothing more than potential routes for ships. The blue ones are any kind of open water ship that would be able to navigate in those areas, both the Northern Sea Route and directly over the pole, and also the red ones are polar class, what we call polar class 6 ships, which are moderately ice resistant ships. So none of these involve heavy ice breaking capability. These are just ships that are out there in large numbers. And you can see that this is not lost on folks that are actively operating within the Arctic. The picture on your left is just Canadian pleasure craft and their increases since 1990 through 2012. So our adventurous spirit is very much playing out in the Arctic, both with little vessels and also larger cruise ships, and we see a growth in that area. And then the leases on the Northern Sea Route that Russia is, the Russian Federation leases, because they're establishing ice mitigation assistance for ships going through there, rose drastically in 2013. So we see those numbers continuing to be on the rise. So I know you all are interested in the Russian military activity. And as you have seen throughout your lives, whenever there's an evolution of human activity into an area, the military activity will be there with it for a variety of different reasons. And the Russians are demonstrating that, I think, fairly clearly. As you know, the United States, second to none, power projection capability with our aircraft, of all types of combat aircraft. I think recently what the Russians have been demonstrating to us is that they have that power projection capacity as well, and they'd like us all to know that. As recently as 2011, there were a lot of reports coming out of very senior defense officials in Russia that indicated that they didn't anticipate a very large increase in military activity in Russia, and there's a lot of press releases that would indicate that. Very drastic change in the last 18 months from everyone up to President Putin, demonstrating a willingness and actually an activity within the Arctic, both basing and also more maritime and air activity. What we in Alaska have seen is we've seen an increase in activity. Frankly, it's a modest increase because we've been, as a nation, involved all over the world in other areas. Frankly, all of the activity that we have been doing day to day in Alaska has been a little bit under the radar, figuratively and literally speaking. We've been intercepting aircraft near our borders for many years. And so we haven't seen a drastic increase, not nearly as drastic as some other areas of the world, but we have seen an increase. But we have seen a fairly dramatic increase in the sophistication of those missions and the types of missions they're flying. A couple of them are pictured here, a couple of Arctic routes you've seen, and then one recent one this past spring that the Japanese and the Koreans got fairly nervous about. We had one here just a couple of months ago where four Russian bombers flew a coordinated profile with two of their air refueling aircraft past the Alaskan airspace. Two of them split off after ensuring the first two primaries were good to go, and those two aircraft flew within 50 miles of the California coast. And you all probably read the press about the submarine that got fairly close to the California coast about a year prior to that. So there is a lot of activity. I will tell you, within the Alaska NORAD region, the activity has been all in accordance with international law. They've not violated our 12-mile territorial limit once. That doesn't mean we're not watching. That doesn't mean we're not identifying and intercepting aircraft, and we are continuing to do that on a regular basis. So I've talked about the Russians a lot, and I don't really want to necessarily focus on that, but I'd be happy to in the Q&A. But what I will say is the Arctic environment where we live and operate as a nation, and then from my perspective as a military, is very much evolving, and there's a lot of interest from many nations, not just the Russians. So I don't want to diffuse the fact that there are many folks that are very, very interested. What we as a military need to be able to do is to evolve with it, and to be able to do that full range of military activities that we've been doing for many years within the Arctic. And I will tell you, we've got a lot of work to do. We do. You know, we've been focused in other areas of the world. The President's Arctic strategy, the Secretary of Defense's Arctic strategy is an important first step, but I think we do have to look long-term, try to look into our crystal ball for what that activity will look like, because it's key terrain for us, it's key terrain economically, militarily, and it's an approach to our homeland. So we need to be prepared not only to operate in it, but defend it, much like you all did on that hill for many years. So thank you for what you did then, for the example that you set for the men and women that I serve with now, so that when I talk to them about this, I can look back a little in history, and I will tell you, I use men and women like you as an example of those that set the foundation for the way we need to be thinking in the future. So thank you very much for your time. I'll be ready to take your questions. I got to finish with the airplane that I'm privileged to fly every now and then.
Questions?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm curious, how in the world do you keep straight all of your various commands? I mean, our lieutenant governor listed a laundry list of commands. Do they overlap? Do they conflict with each other? I mean, how do you keep all of that straight?
Yes, they overlap and they conflict. No, so here's the way we do that. We go out and we advertise what a great career opportunity the United States military is, and then we get, and there's evidence to prove this, we get the best and the brightest of all of the kids coming out of school that really want to come serve with us, and they do all the work. The secret is they do all that stuff, and I just stand up here and take credit for it and talk about it. I'm kind of joking about it, but it's 100% truth. We've got amazing people out there serving in our military today that don't think like I do. When I get a new idea from one of my airmen or one of our soldiers, I have to call my daughter or my son and go, hey, could you translate that for me? But that's good, because I'm live by the old adage that I walk into my office every day and I, you know, there's a dead body laying in the middle of the floor, and I step over it every day. I don't even see that dead body laying there, you know, and a new airman walks in and he goes, hey, what's a dead body doing laying there? Let's figure out how to get that dead body out of your office. Those folks are figuring out new and innovative ways of doing business, and it's not just at the level of folks turning wrenches or flying airplanes. It's supervisors, flight commanders, squadron, you know, group, wing, brigade commanders. So the leadership are those folks that have grown up into those areas. And so we've just got a great support infrastructure supported by a bunch of great families and a tremendous community. And I just kind of keep them pointed, you know, in the right direction.
We need the mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thought I was talking about you. Sir.
Would you comment on the impact of the unquestionable budget support that the Defense Department gets?
That sounded maybe just a little bit sarcastic. No, I tell you, it's... First of all, it's not a surprise. I mean, I served in all those campaigns in the Middle East, and if you study history, you know, at the end of campaigns like that, we typically got a brace for impact. We can typically see some resource challenges. I will tell you, the challenge for us is while that's happening, you know, sort of theoretically, you know, I left Iraq with the last Operation New Dawn folks, and it's heartbreaking, you know, to see what's going on there. And we just sent 350 more folks in there this week. So I think we do need to be cautious with that. I have great faith in our leadership. We've got a lot of folks that I work for that are beating the drum on Capitol Hill to ensure our national leadership understands where we have resource challenges. You know, but I think it also forces us to be a little more creative, you know, a little more effective with the resources that we have. We'll get the job done. I do think what I try to do as best I can is to ensure that not only our military men and women who frankly get paid to be apolitical. That's the cool thing about being a military guy. You have to be apolitical. But we try to ensure that as best we can, we get out and talk to the communities, and so that the communities who elect our representatives understand not only what the numbers say, but what that those numbers mean, so that everybody can participate in that discussion. And I think that's key. I think at some point, everyone needs to understand the impacts. We're doing fine, but we've got the Budget Control Act that's right around the corner. So if new legislation doesn't get passed, we're sort of right back into that in 2016. And so we are preparing for that, and that will be somewhat devastating, to our day-to-day activities. And so I think time will tell on how the future will play out. Sir.
Dr. Khrushchev made a major point that human relationships are so important in international politics and military. I'm curious as to what relationship you might have with your peers and your counterparts in Russia and other parts of the world.
That's a fantastic question, and I think across our whole military structure, which when I say military, I'm including DOD, I'm including our Coast Guard partners, we've had fairly strong partnerships in areas within Russia to date, especially the Coast Guard, frankly. Very, very active and very strong partnership. We partner with the Russians on a number of activities to include, historically, we've done exercises with aircraft that are hijacked, and how would we transfer the identification information on those aircraft and share that so that we could effectively protect our airspace. I will tell you that has come to a very steep halt, and there's not a lot of that going on now. So the tension that's happening elsewhere in the world is having a tangible impact on our ability to continue to partner, and that is a problem, because that partnership, much like you're seeing some similar partnerships with other nations like China keep us out of fights in the Pacific, is critically important. I think if you stop talking, you're on the road to conflict. Sir.
Toward that end, you read the lines in the President's Arctic Strategy. Russia considers its waters to be internal waters, and we support freedom of navigation, and there was some suggestion in the strategy we have a freedom of navigation exercise. Have you thought about how that might take place in the Arctic, and what other resources do you need in the Arctic?
I have, and I think that's an important exercise to have. And you see us doing a lot of this elsewhere in the world. So there's very close analogies on that. And I would agree with you. I think we do have a bit of a difference in perspective as to what international airspace and waters are. And I believe that ours is overwhelmingly the majority international opinion, and I think we ought to demonstrate that through partnerships with our friends and allies. And so we are talking about that. I don't have a lot on the horizon right now, and so we'll see where this friction takes us on that, but I think that's important. What we need in the Arctic is a broad question, and I think we have the most work to do on that question. So the President published a strategy and an implementation plan, as did the Secretary of Defense. As you might imagine, it's fairly broad. It's a national-level policy. We are doing a lot of things here at the tactical level, and we have recognized some capability shortfalls in our ability to operate. So an expeditionary basing, if we were to have to do a large-scale search and rescue, do we have enough equipment to drop in on an area and be able to operate out of there? Do we have the right kind of sustainment and operating vehicles for our soldiers, the right kind of gloves and hats and coats, I mean, right down to the skis that they wear. And so we are identifying a lot of those requirements. What's very important for us right now is our combatant commander, the Northern Command commander, is working on a deliberate plan. It's his number one planning priority now, which will establish that combatant command set of requirements, which we can then take to the services. That's a critical node, military budget speak. If you don't have one of these operational commanders, a four-star combatant commander, communicating a list of requirements in today's environment, it doesn't survive contact with the services, it doesn't survive contact with Capitol Hill. And so that's ongoing, and we're gonna see that very soon, and we're actively participating with them in that. So I think what you'll see come out of that are some of those requirements like I implied.
Time for one more.
Sir, I think I saw your hand up a little bit. Yes, sir.
Yes, would you talk a little bit about whether or not there's a formal or informal process for communications between the military in Alaska and the state government on issues that affect civilian populations or civilian activities that affect military operations, how that operates. Over time, there appears to be a bit slightly different processes. And tell us what that looks like today.
I will, and first I'll give you my opinion, and having served in a lot of states, and I'm not blowing smoke, it's the best I've ever seen here. I mean, we really have, no kidding, we have a great relationship with the state and the communities, and I humbly think we've got a fairly strong relationship as well with our tribes, with our tribal elders, 229 of those here in the state of Alaska. And there's a variety of different ways we keep that active, and I always hesitate to say, hey, it's really good, we've got a great process, because if I say that, then I stop working on it. So it's a continual work in progress, and as we see new leaders, both within the military, which is more frequently, and within our elected officials, you know, we need to keep that actively involved. But we have some very, very firm processes. I think a lot of that is because we're such a small town in the largest state in the union, and so we think like a small town atmosphere, and we get together quite a bit at the base level. There's a number of different programs to include honorary commander, civilian advisory board members, and the formal relationships here at J-Bear. I'll give you a great example. Right on this installation, if we have an incident that involves a disaster in the local area, every piece of command and control we need to initially react to that, from the local to state level and from the DOD support perspective, is right on the installation of J-Bear, to include all of my headquarters. U.S. Coast Guard District 17 Anchorage Sector is in the Armory, in the Alaska Guard. Within that same building is the State Emergency Operations Center. We just exercised this in March. Every other year, the Federal Emergency Management Agency does a giant disaster exercise. They pick the biggest, hardest challenges, and they focus on that only every 2 years, and it was an Alaska scenario in March. So the entire nation, the National Security Council, all the commands, you know, FEMA, state, local officials, DOD, we were all focused on that. And it was fantastic, and it showed two things. It showed all of those processes that we've had that were really good, and then it showed all the things that we need to work on, you know, to make them better. So in my office, I've got this spreadsheet. It's about 6 feet wide, you know, with a lot of little blocks. Like all good events, it generates more work than it solved. But I got to tell you, when we sit down at the table with our state and our local officials, everybody rolls up their sleeves and they go to work on it. So I honestly feel it's strong, and I don't think you're going to find anybody that would disagree with me on that. Thanks for that question. And sorry, I'd love to chat further, but you've got a lot more distinguished speakers that you don't want to miss. I will say thanks again for allowing me to be here and speak to you today. I'm kind of humbled, because I do think you guys are heroes. You're heroes to me. You're heroes to my kids. And someday when I have grandkids, I'll be telling them about you as well. So thanks for everything that you did for your nation.
General Hannity, you have a nice watch here.
Obviously, I ignored it.
We heard the story about the nice watch yesterday from Dr. Khrushchev as well. I just want to echo what you said about the relationship. I, as Lieutenant Governor, and I know we'll hear from General Bridges later this morning, we very much appreciate the very close relationship that we have with you and the Coast Guard. And I believe that's helped the state a number of different ways, keep misunderstandings from happening, keep lives saved, support our troops, which is very important to do. And I can tell you that for those of you who are veterans who are returning to Alaska, maybe even for the first time since you served here, this is a great place. And one of the things that is evidence of that is that so many people who serve under your command decide to retire and return. And we even hope you might do that someday. We'd love to have you. I've always wanted to keep a good relationship with the head of the Alaska Command, because after 9/11, it was the head of the Alaska Command and the head of Northern Command were the two generals who have the authority to shoot down a passenger airliner. If I send you my itinerary every time I fly, that's what's behind that, General.